right. sounds like so high school as well. So no one wants to hang around with these with these things. You know, it's like, where did that come from? What are you talking about? And the one thing that clearly and utterly lacks, right, is this idea of, like, forgiveness and, like, empathy and, like, thinking about victims and turning the other cheek.
Welcome to something new we're trying on this channel, a science and philosophy panel, hence the name, Sci-Fi Show. So as some of you may know, I've made documentaries with leading physicists and philosophers, and two of my absolute star talking heads are here for what we hope will be maybe a somewhat regular discussion of science, philosophy, and how they intersect with the philosophy of religion. So let's meet our panel. So first we have Alex Malpass. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're drinking.
I'm Alex, and I've been on your show a couple of times, well, on your channel a couple of times, I guess. Because I have a background in philosophy, philosophy of religion stuff these days. And I'm drinking a donut party chocolate truffle donut milk stout, which sounds actually a bit better than it is, but it's quite nice anyway. So, yeah, that's me.
And Dan Linford, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, so I have a PhD in philosophy from Purdue University. In my doctoral dissertation, I worked on the Kalama cosmological argument and its relationship to physics, which is how I got connected with Phil. Currently, I'm a postdoctoral fellow in a biophysics laboratory. So my research runs the gamut from pure physics to philosophy. And I'm currently drinking green tea.
Okay.
Cool. Time zone is a bit different now, isn't it? So, it's a bit more zone.
Right. So look, cards on the table. All three of us are non-believers, and this show, amongst other things, will offer counters to leading apologists. And who better to start with than the king of apologetics, William Lane Craig? So recently Craig was on my friend Alex O'Connor's show, and he was talking about these defending the slaughter of the Canaanites, divine command theory, but also fine-tuning. And we're going to start with his summing up of Richard Dawkins' critique of God in the classic book The God Delusion. So let's have a listen to that clip, and we'll see what we think.
The appearance of design in the natural world is overwhelming, but nevertheless, Darwin has given us an adequate naturalistic explanation of instances of biological design. We don't yet have, he says, a similar explanation in physics for the fine tuning of the universe for life, but Darwin's success in biology ought to give us confidence that such an explanation will be forthcoming in physics. Therefore, God almost certainly does not exist. At the very best, it's simply an argument that one ought not to use the teleological argument or the argument for design. But then in addition to that, several of the propositions that I mentioned are very questionable. For example, that Darwin has given an adequate explanation for the appearance of design in the biological realm is controverted. The claim that that should give us confidence that in a totally different field of science, in physics and cosmology, that an explanation is right around the corner for the remarkable fine-tuning of the universe. I don't know of any physicist who thinks that that proposition is true.
Okay. So Dan, you're our physics expert here. So why don't you give us your feedback on this? What do you think about
that? Yeah, right. So I've got a bunch of things I want to say here. Like the first one is that, so throughout this video, Craig keeps saying that various claims that Dawkins makes can be controverted. Well, so what? To say that some view can be controverted just means that someone else can provide a contrary argument. Many of the claims that Craig himself makes, both his writing and in this video, can themselves be controverted. What matters isn't whether someone's claims can be controverted. Instead, what matters is whether they've offered a plausible or cogent argument. Now, I don't want to defend Dawkins's book, because I think that The God Delusion is not the best book on this topic that I've read. Very far from it, in fact. If you want to see a more thorough defense of, like, the central argument that Dawkins provides in his book by a professional philosopher, Eric Weilenberg has a great paper that came out a long time ago that combines what Dawkins says in his for argument with some arguments from David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. But what I do want to talk about is the role of teleology in physics. So the first thing that I think we should talk about is the fact that we need to be really careful about how we think about fine-tuning. So there's two distinct ways that the phrase fine-tuning has been used in the literature. First is what we might call fine-tuning in the philosopher's sense, is the sense most commonly used in philosophy religion. In the philosopher's sense, fine-tuning refers to a feature that the universe supposedly has, namely that the physical constants are somehow precariously balanced in just the right way in order to allow for the existence of life. When philosophers of religion use the phrase fine-tuning in that sense, they are assuming that our understanding of physics will not dramatically change in the future. And so that involves a tremendous kind of faith in our current physical theories that I simply do not share, and that I don't actually think that most physicists share. So I don't think we should have good reason. I don't think we have good reason to believe in fine-tuning in the philosopher's sense. But there's a second kind of, there's a second sense of the phrase fine-tuning, the sense that I do think that fine-tuning exists in this sense, which I'm going to call the physicist sense as opposed to the philosopher's sense. In this sense, fine-tuning does not refer to a property of the universe. Instead, fine-tuning refers to a feature of some scientific theories. So we said that a parameter appearing in some scientific theory is fine-tuned just in case, in order to make the theory consistent with some body of observations, we need to set the value of that parameter to some implausible or unnatural value. In turn, a theory can be fine-tuned just in case the theory includes a fine-tuned parameter. So while I'm skeptical of fine-tuning in the philosopher's sense, I do believe in fine-tuning in the physicist's sense. That is, there really are theories that are fine-tuned, and the fine-tuners of those theories are the physicists that write down those theories.
All right, Dan, but let me press you a little bit. What do you think about this comment where he said, he sort of dismissed ideas that, you know, there can't be explanations from physics. There's no explanation around the corner, I think was the phrase he used. He doesn't think any physicists think that. My problem was, if what he means is there's no explanation, if he means there's none on the table, I mean, that just seems obviously wrong, right? Because we've got multiverse explanation, we've got some people just dismiss that there's any notion of fine-tuning in the philosopher's sense. And of course, there's even a Darwinian explanation that Craig himself has critiqued. So he obviously knows it exists. So if that's what he means, that's obviously false. Now, if he means where there's no agreed upon explanation, well, that may be true, but then, you know, that's true of lots of theological things that he defends. The third thing is, well, maybe there's no, he doesn't think anyone's going to have a new explanation, but of course we can't anticipate new discoveries. So what did you think of that comment?
Yeah, so I think, so what Craig is attributing to Dawkins is an argument of the following kind. So he thinks that Dawkins is saying that the appearance of design in biology has a naturalistic explanation in terms of Darwinian evolution. We can then make an inductive step or an inductive leap from biology to physics. And so we should expect the naturalistic explanation of apparent design wherever it arises in physics. For example, in the apparent design of the fine-tuning of the physical constants. Now, Craig, as you point out, claims he doesn't know of any physicists who think that we can make that kind of inductive leap from apparent design in biology to apparent design in physics. But I think there's two important things to note here. The first is that, so the fact that what we thought was design, or what was obvious science of design in biology, turns out to have a thoroughly naturalistic explanation, means that our intuitive judgments about what is designed and what isn't can be called into question. So when some feature in physics appears to be designed, we already have reason to think that maybe our judgments of that kind are not really trustworthy. The other thing to be said, and I think this is what you really want to get to, is that we do actually have proposals in physics for Darwinian-type mechanisms. So Lee Smolin has this cosmological model in which universes are born out of black holes. The way that it works is that each time that a black hole appears in some universe, or material that is like goes through that black hole into a subsequent universe, the physical constants are changed, maybe the laws of physics are changed, and the the universes that will come to dominate the population of all of those universes are going to be those that have the most black holes. So you, if there's some way in which the physical constants change only some slight amount from one universe to a daughter universe, then the universe that become most populous are going to be those that tend to produce the most offspring, right? So that's a purely Darwinian type mechanism, but applied in a cosmological context. But not only do we have models like Smolens, which are admittedly speculative, if we look back into the history of physics, there are past examples of design arguments that have been met with mechanisms that are similar to Darwinian mechanisms. So for instance, you can ask this kind of question. If you notice that an object follows some trajectory through space, you can ask, why did it follow that particular trajectory? Why did it go along that particular path, as opposed to all the other paths that it could have taken? Here's an interesting mathematical fact. There's a mathematical function that you can write down that will assign a number to each of the possible different paths that an object could take. And it turns out that the path that objects actually take are the paths that minimize that function. We see that objects follow the path of least action. In the 18th century, Pierre-Louis Maupertuis first articulated this idea as part of his theology. For Maupertuis, God does nothing to excess. So everything in nature travels along the path of least action. Now, some atheists will tell you that religion never provided anything to science. But here's a case where they are absolutely wrong. The principle of least action was originally a theological hypothesis, and yet turns out to underlie almost all of physics that we have today. Moreover, this is a positive contribution made by a design argument. Maupertuis argued that the exceptionless economical design of nature in terms of the principle of least action revealed God's wisdom, and in his view, proved that God exists. Maupertuis told us that how he would expect God would design the physical world, and in turn, when we investigated the physical world, it turned out that Maupertuis was entirely right. But here's the trouble. Here's where Darwin comes in. We now have a thoroughly naturalistic explanation for why objects traverse the path of least action. So you may have heard that in quantum mechanics, there's a sense in which particles also have a wave nature. And you might have also heard that waves can destructively interfere. So the crest of one wave can cancel out the trough of another wave. It turns out that what objects do on a quantum mechanical level is that they traverse every possible path between the beginning state and the end state. But all of those paths, except for the one that minimizes the action, cancels out. And so on the macroscopic scale, on the scale of ordinary dry goods, what we actually see are objects minimizing the action. And so we have a thoroughly naturalistic explanation for the apparent teleology that we find in some parts of physics.
Alex, what are your thoughts?
I thought all of that stuff that Dan was saying then was super interesting. I didn't know any of that, so that's really great. So I've learned something already, so that's good. I think you and I talked about this the other day, Phil, and I think we may have had maybe there's some ambiguity about what he said, because it was an off-the-cuff sentence that didn't have a very tight sentence structure, so it wasn't quite clear exactly what he was saying. To my ear, what he was saying was that Dawkins thought that that physicists took Darwin's success to be enough to say that you could, it's definitely going to rule out fine-tuning at some point, there'll be some physical explanation, and that he just thought that no physicist thinks like that. They're not referring to Darwin when they make comments about fine-tuning or whatever. And I think, if I understand what Dan's saying, then they're not really talking about Darwin. I mean, like Darwinian theories, like Smolens or whatever. But it's not. You could have come up with that if Darwin hadn't come up with his theory. It doesn't actually matter what Darwin said. They're actually logically independent of each other. And nobody's saying, well, because Darwin was so successful, we'll probably rule out fine-tuning. I mean, on the other hand, you know, you do kind of tend to think, well, science is explaining stuff, isn't it? And it's a slow drip-by-drip progress towards more and more explanation. And Darwin is an example of that happening. you could have also picked, you know, any other successful explanatory theory in the history of science as support for the thought that, like, eventually science will figure this out or something. I mean, it does seem to me that probably that is my view. I think at some point there will be a sort of satisfying scientific explanation for this.
What Dawkins seems to be doing is using the argument of design against the theist. He's not just saying, well, Darwin solves the problem of design, therefore God doesn't exist. Rather, that what we've learned about the way we solve the problem of design implies that anything that can do design work must be complex, and it can't be there at the origin of reality, because it would have to go through this long process. That's the way we get to complexity. So the way, of course, Craig could come back is to say, yes, that might be true, but God isn't complex. But that's a different argument, and that's what I think you'd have to defend. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, that's what, so in, I mentioned Wielenberg's article, and to be honest, I don't remember how that article exactly goes, but I remember he presents a fork in that article between these two different conceptions of God, either as a simple or non-simple being, but then shows that on one of those forks, Dawkins' argument can be taken up, and on the other fork, Hume has an argument that can be taken up.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think what I want to say is that there's an sort of inconsistency with the way he treats the design argument and the way he treats the problem of evil, because that's going to be our next clip. So I'll dive into that in a second. But the setup basically is that he seems very dismissive of attempts to solve fine tuning. We know there are solutions to fine tuning on the table, right? It's true that not everyone agrees with each solution. You know, some favor a multiverse with anthropic selection. Some people think it's a non-problem at all. And of course, we've got Smolin's Darwinian solution. And he's very dismissive of those. But then, see what he says about the problem of evil.
I think that we've already resolved the problem of evil, that the problem of evil places a burden of proof upon the shoulders of the atheist that is so heavy that no one has been able to sustain it. And so I think there's been tremendous progress in the history of philosophy with regard to these anti-theistic arguments. I think that Dawkins' confidence on the basis of Darwin's achievement is greatly exaggerated. We can talk about that more if you want to, but I don't think that contemporary evolutionary theory bears that out at all. It's extremely controverted today.
So I think what Craig's saying is kind of, yeah, I think you're right that it's weird. It's almost like cherry picking or something. Because he's super, super skeptical about whether or not natural selection is a thing, even though it's got massive, overwhelming hundreds of years of scientific consensus. And yeah, he's skeptical about that because of, like, presumably contemporary intelligent design stuff, right? He's really sympathetic to that. It just so happens that that's the view that's, you know, simpatico with his religious beliefs. You know, just by chance, he just happens to be super sympathetic to the view that backs up his religious convictions. But so, yeah, obviously, it looks like a case of motivated reasoning, right? He's siding with the thing that just happens to cohere with his, like, not just his, like, worldview, but also his career and, you know, well, his identity is wrapped up with all of this stuff. So it's not exactly surprising. And I mean, maybe everyone does that to some extent, but it's weird that they, I guess the guy's entitled to his own opinion as well. I mean, whatever, it's just some person explaining the way that it strikes him, I guess. But yeah, that, you know, certainly doesn't strike us like that. I think most scientific people would find that a bizarre view to hold. And but just briefly on the problem of evil, it seems to me that there he thought that the problem was like that massive work had been done on it, and you know, basically it's already been solved, because just before that Alex O'Connor was saying something like you know, this thought experiment about being 200 years in the future or whatever, and he just couldn't imagine in 200 years in the future, I think this was this point, that we would have, like, solved the problem of evil. It would still be just as much of a problem as it is today. I think that was a general idea. And Craig was saying, well, actually, I think we don't have to go to time machine. We've basically already solved it. And I think what he has in mind there is that it's really just that Mackey's logical problem of evil and Plantinga's response to that. And that's it. I think that's just all he means, as if there's nothing going on about it.
I think he means a little bit more than that. So I think he certainly has in mind what you just said for the logical problem. But as I think we would agree, like that doesn't it's not fully decisively a solution of the logical problem. As he would say, that can be controverted. But I think he also has in mind that the evidential problem, in his view, is solved by something like skeptical theism. Sometimes I've seen him say that he's not a skeptical theist. But then if you look at places where some of the places where he responds to the evidential problem, he says the kinds of things that skeptical theists say. So he seems
So
like a skeptical theist to me.
when he said that it places a massive burden of evidence on the atheist, is that some part of like skeptical
I
theism?
think it is. I think what he's
I think,
saying.
yes, but I think there's another level as well. So that's one part of it. I think another part is that like he has sometimes taken up this view that atheists can't legitimately launch the problem of evil because atheists, on his view, can't ground objective moral facts.
Right. But I think what he was also saying that you have to be able to say God couldn't have some good reason to allow an evil. And that's the burden that the atheists can't meet.
Right. And that's not even a burden that the atheist needs to meet to launch the problem of evil, right? Like what the atheist needs is that the kinds of or some facts about the evils that we observe in our world are in tension with theism. But the combination of those facts about evil and theism is implausible. It doesn't need to be that like it's not possible that God could have any possible reason to do X, Y, or Z. Like
Right,
that would
right.
be way too high of a burden.
But then that's what I was thinking was he must be talking about kind of logical problems of evil because, I mean, just the mere possibility of a coherent resolution is enough if you have this kind of logical problem. But if we're talking about like the kind of preponderance of evidence and, you know, where the probabilities lie, then you can't just hypothesize with some random motivation. I mean, like you have to like show somehow that that's plausible to suppose that it has that motivation. That seems to me, you know, different. You can't just hand wave that away by saying an atheist has a ridiculous burden of proof here, but like as if they have to rule out any possible coherent resolution or
Right.
something, right? But that it seems to me that's what Plantinga's pushback was to
Yeah,
Matthew.
but this is the way that Craig seems to interact with evidential problems in general, right? So like for instance, when you debated him, you weren't saying that it's not possible that the past could be finite, right? Like your view is that it is possible the past could be finite. But nonetheless, like he thinks that unless you demonstrate that the past is infinite, that he somehow won.
Right.
And I think that that's like a strategy that he, or that like is connected to this view that he has that he sometimes expresses this idea that like if that we should have a very low bar, very low evidential burden for theism because I don't know, maybe of all of the prudential work it could do in someone's life or something. But but he said this publicly that he thinks that like we should very easily accept the truth of Christian theism. Whereas like the burden for the contrary view he thinks should be much higher. And so I think part of what might be going on here is like unless you can somehow like very decisively rule out a view contrary to his, he thinks that we ought to accept his view.
Right. And I want to go back to the comment that he made about evolution is extremely controversial. I have to
I don't
say,
think
I
that's what he
don't.
said.
I think that is what he said.
No, I think what he said was that
Go ahead, correct me.
the idea that evolution provides a naturalistic explanation for all apparent design in the biological realm is controverted, which is a distinct claim from claiming that evolution is controversial, right? So like so for instance, he could think like Michael Behe does that, you know, you have evolutionary mechanisms all over the place, but then when it comes to some like very special features like the bacterial flagellum, then that's like the place where God has to come in.
Right, but do you think many biologists would think that that's correct, that we need to
No,
kind of
I still think that that's like contrary to what biologists would say. I think, you know, it's nowhere near as controversial as he seems to think that it is.
Yeah, because the phrase was
That's
extremely
right.
controverted. Yeah. I mean, I think
Yeah, right.
what's needed for Dawkins' argument is we've got at least a principle that we can show that something that looks designed is not designed, right? So you can't go from the appearance of design to the conclusion of design. And that, I think, is what we need here.
Yeah, well, I think it's not even that, because it's like the kinds of design inferences that people before the 19th century typically took themselves to make are the kinds of judgments we should be skeptical of. But for instance, there are scientific fields when people make design inferences. So in archaeology, people, but like it turns out that over the history of archaeology, objects that at one time people thought were artifacts turn out not to be. There's this really famous case involving these stones that are called eoliths that apparently are found in Europe. People used to think that they're arrowheads that were left by Stone Age peoples. Eolith means dawn stone, so stones from the dawn of man. And it turns out that eoliths are actually produced by glaciers rolling over rocks. And that since that time, archaeologists have worked out very stringent rules for, like, very stringent methodologies for when you can legitimately make design inferences, when you cannot. Those kinds of rules have not been paid, like, natural theologians do not pay attention to that kind of literature, in part because, like, it's unclear how you could even apply it. Like, one of the rules is that you have to, if you can recreate an object, and notice, like, tool marks are created by the reproduction process, then you can, if you can find those same tool marks in, like, some rock somewhere or something, that's a good evidence of, like, that was produced by that process. But, like, none of us are going to, like, cook up a universe in our laboratory.
Right.
And so another criterion like that is that if you find objects in conjunction with human remains, that's some evidence that those objects were used by humans. But what would that even mean in the case of a theological design argument? So there's the kind of methodological principles people have come up with for making design inferences are just not the kinds of principles that are employed in natural theology when people try to make inferences about the design of biological systems or about the universe.
So we're going to move on to the discussion between Alex O'Connor and William Lane Craig on the slaughter of the Canaanites. And of course, the Bible justifies this by saying, well, they deserved it. And I think we should be skeptical of that. But here in this next clip, Craig's going to claim extra biblical sources.
This is not simply biblically attested. I have a colleague, Professor Clay Jones, who has done a study of ancient literature coming out of pre-Israelite Canaan. And it is horrific. The culture that is described there, this was one that practiced not only all sorts of human sexual aberrations, but also temple prostitution in the worship of God. They practiced bestiality, offering child sacrifice to their gods. And so reading these ancient documents that are from pre-Israelite Canaan really bear out the truth of the biblical description of them.
Okay, I want to start off on this one, because even if it were true that the Canaanites deserved everything that they got, why were the animals slaughtered? Were they evil too? Craig just doesn't address this at all, or at least not in this video. But Alex, why don't we go on to you? What are your thoughts?
For one thing, he references this his colleague, Clay Jones, right? And so we read that paper before this, and my word, it is a wild, crazy ride, that paper. Oh my days, what is going on there? So for those people watching who haven't read it, he lists off lots of the sort of immoralities of the Canaanites, and starting off with idolatry, which, you know, it just seems super unfair. I mean, like, they're not the same religion as you. That's not a moral failing, you know, like, they don't worship the same thing. But he seems to think that idolatry, there's this like chain of reasoning you can go through that idolatry leads to like homosexuality or whatever. And it's just like, what's going on here? What am I reading? You know, it's just absolute insanity. Homosexuality, you thought was just some kind of sexual aberration as well. It's just like pouring in these contemporary, I guess, American evangelical morality into this. Obviously, some of the stuff that the Canaanites were accused of doing was immoral even under my own lights as well, right? Like, I mean, incest, bestiality, stuff like that, child sacrifice, things like that. Fair enough. Okay, so if they were doing that, they were well, probably quite normal ancient people. Welcome to ancient history. It's full of like gruesome, horrible things that humans used to do all the time. Pretty much any time in history, before about 50 years ago, it seems to me, is completely unacceptable. you couldn't pay me to go. So that's just what it's like. So there's just a couple of things that, like, the Clay Jones paper is just absolute insanity. Okay, I no doubt there's going to be some literature out there which demonizes the Canaanites, ancient literature, because it's bound to be, right? There's the people were invading each other, tribes fighting each other, people like feuds and hating each other. That stuff just part of human nature. You're bound to have one group saying, these lads over here that we're going to attack tomorrow, they're actually, turns out, they're all like the worst possible human beings ever. So that's like, that's what every person ever who's invaded anyone has told their soldiers about them. So it's bound to be, and use it post facto to justify what they did. However, he did seem to be referencing, and it's not possible for me to sort of verify this, but he did seem to be referencing, you know, their own legal code, which I thought was actually quite surprising that they'd have stuff written down like that.
He did one like the Hittites. The Hittites said it was you were not allowed to have sex with animals apart from one or two animals.
Yeah,
right. Which is very strange. Why that would be, I don't know, but who can say? But they certainly did prohibit sex with animals in most cases. Yeah. But to me, like, what's interesting is Craig sidestepped the issue of killing the animals. Clay Jones didn't. He actually addresses it. And I want to read out what he said. So basically, you know, he says, well, they had sex with animals, so they should be killed. And here's the quote from Clay Jones. He said, "The Lord ordered that those who have sex with animals should be put to death along with the animal." Atheist Richard Dawkins objects that it adds injury to insult that the unfortunate beast is to be killed too. But what Dawkins and others don't grasp is that only the depraved would want to have animals around who were used to having sex with humans, close quote. Basically, these animals have been raped and they should be killed because we don't want to be around them.
Yeah, insane. I don't
imagine.
Imagine
going to, like, you know, one of these places where you can, like, adopt animals that have been, like, humane societies and so on, and like finding a bunch of dogs and cats that had been like previously like raped by their owners, and then just saying, oh, we should just kill all of them.
Right, don't adopt them because you'd be depraved if you wanted to hang around with the victims of abuse. You'd be absolutely depraved to do that.
But it sounds like so high school as well. So no one wants to hang around with these things, you know. It's like, where did that come from? What are you talking about? And the one thing that clearly and utterly lacks, right, is this idea of, like, forgiveness and, like, empathy and, like, thinking about victims and turning the other cheek. All this, like, Jesus stuff that, you know, you'd think would be so natural to them as their worldview to see it like that.
I wonder, maybe, Phil, you can talk about this, but so all the forgiveness stuff, of course, is what Craig is going to say is applies to people, and why that doesn't apply to the Canaanite children is another difficult thing to understand. But, like, but as far as the animals go, on Craig's view, from what I've seen of your work on this, Phil, Craig thinks that animals are in some, like, really strong sense, very distinct from human beings in the kind of, like, sentience they have, and the kind of experience they have, the kind of suffering that they can undergo, or lack thereof, really.
Yeah. I mean, he has in the past said that, you know, the animals don't suffer, or at least they're not aware of their suffering. He did say the higher primates do suffer, so why they get off the hook, I don't know. But but anyway, and we've published, you know, a paper in peer-reviewed journal showing exactly why that's wrong. Right. And it would be nice if you could reply to that. I appreciate, you know, I have to say that Justin Briley invited me to debate William Lane Craig and he refused. And maybe that looks good on my CV or not on his. I don't know. But you know, but he has done 7 podcasts replying to me, I think it is. So maybe that would be okay. But anyway, the point is he hasn't replied to that paper in the literature. And maybe he still has that view. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know. But Clay Jones didn't appeal to that. And the other thing he didn't mention about Clay Jones is that, you know, Clay Jones is a Christian apologist by like profession. Shouldn't he sort of mention that this is not an ancient historian? I think that's a kind of relevant fact here. And what he doesn't also mention is that the Israelites have also been accused of the very same things. Like, obviously, they practice idolatry. That's why Moses crashed the two tablets, right? Also, there's a book I think would be good to read for Child Sacrifice in Ancient Israel. and it's by Heath D. Durrell, who is at Princeton Theological Seminary. And I'll quote from it here. Insofar as we can tell, there are at least 3 different rites that involve the sacrifice of children to Yahweh in Iron Age Israel, close quote. So, yeah, I'm sure you can point out bad things the Canaanites did, but are we really saying other cultures didn't?
Well, even according to the Bible, people were at least prepared to sacrifice their own children to Yahweh. I mean, that's the Abraham and Isaac story. And the only reason why that sacrifice doesn't go through is because Abraham is subsequently commanded not to go through with it. But like, it was supposed to be this great sign of loyalty on Abraham's part that he was thoroughly ready to sacrifice Isaac. But yeah, I mean, there's also, I mean, as you know, Fillers, there's also William Deaver's Did God Have a Wife, exploring this issue of polytheism in ancient Israel. And I'm sure as you may know, my understanding, anyway, is that among historians, mainstream historians and archaeologists, there's really no distinction between late Canaanite culture and early Israelite culture, that the one gave rise to the other. That, for instance, late Canaanite language is basically indistinguishable from early Hebrew, that words like Yahweh and El are taken from the Canaanite religion, and that the Exodus story is believed by mainstream historians to be mythical. That there's no evidence of some sort of like large group of people that made their way from Egypt to Canaan. And the explanation I've seen given before as to like why we have these stories about the Canaanites being so bad was it was like the subsequent culture looking back and saying like, let's not return to these old ways. We have this new thing we're doing now, so we need to stick with this. And in fact, it was so different back then that wasn't even us. Like, we came in and displaced them somehow.
Yeah, I recently read a very good book. I forgot the name of it, but it's about biblical archaeology. And again, the mainstream view is that the origin of the Israelites is from Canaan. They were the Canaanites, basically. So people should know that the Canaanite god El, the name Israel means to struggle with El. Right? So it seems that they were one and the same. So this looks like a very, very weak argument. But also I think there's a tension between the next thing that he says.
Now, maybe the men and women were immoral. I certainly don't think that children living among the Canaanites were immoral enough to justify their being killed, and certainly not the cattle, the sheep, and the donkeys.
Right. The difficult, I think, aspect of this is the children. The adults were corrupt. If there was an innocent person among the adults, that person didn't have to be killed. It's important to understand that God's command to Israel was not genocide, despite a superficial first reading of these narratives. More fundamentally, it was a command to drive the Canaanites out of the land on pain of death. No one had to be killed if these tribes would simply retreat and flee in the face of the advancing Israeli army. It was only those who tried to stay behind and resist who were to be completely exterminated. God has the right to take anyone's life whenever he wants to. Unfortunately, children die all the time in infancy. And so if God wants to end the life of these Canaanite children early or prematurely, that's his prerogative. But then secondly, on my theology, these children go immediately to heaven.
So is there a tension there between saying the Canaanites deserved it and, oh, they could just flee if they wanted to? Like, if they deserved it, they shouldn't be allowed to flee, right? Like, which is it?
Yeah, it seems to be such a desperate attempt to reconcile clearly extremely problematic aspect of his religion without addressing it head on. I mean, it's desperate. I mean, I'm not normally one for saying, for reaching for hyperbole, especially when talking about Craig. Everyone's all like, oh, Craig's a liar, he's blah, blah, blah. Most of the time, you just think, this guy's just a philosopher making claims you don't agree with. Like, just calm down about it. But, like, right here, it really is just kind of ridiculous what's going on. It's kind of offensive, really. That's why everyone's got so worked up about this, I think. But, I mean, there's so many things that are, like, on its face, it doesn't matter what the Canaanites were like. Right? It's got absolutely nothing to do with anything, because let's just suppose they were the most ridiculously immoral people, whatever. God's an omnipotent being. It doesn't matter. Just change their minds, or send a flood, or make them all go to sleep, or anything you like, any of the infinite possibilities that you could come up with. I've just, like, just scattergunned a couple of different options there, right? But even that, so what, right? What difference does it, if you've got some land, there's someone on there, make a new bit of land. Who cares what bit of land it is? Why are you so obsessed with that? Like, the only reason, obviously, that what's going on is it, like, just compare and contrast. Right? On the one hand, you've got this, like, desperate attempt at reconciling this nonsense reconciliation of what's going on there. And on the other hand, that's like, if you have to try and maintain that God is good and that God exists and that, you know, this is all true and blah, 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 blah. On the other hand, if you just look at it as, like, obviously none of that stuff, all of those presuppositions, they're all just false, right? This isn't a religious book. It's just a book written by people. And what was going on was just, this is a struggle of two tribes over a bit of land. Why do they care about it? Because they're not omnipotent beings. They've got to, like, scrape a living out of some bit of soil somewhere. So it really matters to them where they live. So they've got to, like, invade and take over a piece of land. The archetypal human activity. Really, if you think about it, that's all the whole history, the story of the human, the history of humanity is just like different groups of people stealing land off each other at a certain level of abstraction. Right? It just makes perfect sense there. That's like the hypothesis that's way simpler, provides a much more satisfying explanation of what's going on. And otherwise, you know, why the obsession with the land? Why the obsession with what they're like? Right? It doesn't make any difference. So, I guess my a priori thought is just that, like, he could have just snapped his fingers and made anything happen. So, why on earth, if you had that power, would you think, I know what I'll do? I'll order them to, like, beat the brains out of every living creature in that chunk of land. It just makes absolutely no sense. This is, like, even I think this is the most forceful thing. Is that, like, I don't care. Don't even care about how bestial these people were. It doesn't matter. It's completely irrelevant. It would matter if you were talking about an authority with finite resources, perhaps. I mean, maybe then you're picking between limited options or something. Not the case here, right? That's at least according to the hypothesis we're supposed to be examining. It's an omnipotent being. So that, you know, that just brushes all of this aside. It doesn't matter about what they were doing, who they were, anything like that. Like, as if he, like, promised the land to the Israelites, and there was nothing he could do apart from, like, order them to attack one another, do the most natural human thing that humans always do throughout the whole of history. Just happened to find that was the thing you're... It's just preposterous, right? It's absolutely absurd.
Well, God could have just teleported the Canaanites to somewhere else, right? I mean, if the objective was clearing the land, he could have done that, but no, instead he decided on the most violent approach with the maximal amount of suffering for the Canaanites and their animals.
There's this really strange thing that I've noticed both in Craig's work and in talking to just lay Christians. On one hand, there's this, like, failure of imagination that Alex is pointing out, where it's like, there's this failure to really comprehend what an omnipotent being would really be like. Like, it's the, but on the other hand, Craig says that, oh, for Middle Eastern peoples, maybe even for, like, present day Middle Eastern peoples, I won't mention how, like, racist some of this language sounds to me, but in any case, that he says that, like, for these people groups, the land has this, like, really great importance. why is that relevant to his theology? Mm-hmm. Like, he would tell us that the concerns, like the moral concerns that people have today, are provincial and cultural, and that, you know, they don't have to reflect like God's perfect morality, which is supposed to transcend all of us. Shouldn't the same thing be true of ancient cultures? Why should I care, in constructing a theological position, whether a particular people group cares about land?
Right. And the other thing is, in the story of the Amalekites, they're ordered to kill every living thing, including the women, the children, the animals. And then Saul doesn't kill everything. He actually keeps some animals for himself. And God is unhappy, right? He actually condemns Saul for that. So if it were the case that they just wanted to clear the land and that was it, why was God so unhappy that they kept some of the animals? Why was he? And I think the king of the Amalekites was kept as a prisoner and they didn't kill him. And God was unhappy about that. If they wanted to just clear the land, why was God so unhappy about that? It seems to me the real theme here is obedience. That what really the theme is, you must obey all the commands, no matter how violent. And that's the real theme.
I mean, that's the theme that you find in the Abraham and Isaac story. It's the theme that you find in this story. It's the theme that you find in Job. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like people sometimes think that they can read some kind of like skeptical theism or Mysterianism into the end of Job, but that's not really what's going on in Job, right? Like when Job challenges God to give an explanation for God's actions, God says, "Well, who are you to dare to question me? You right. like pitiful, you know, little creature." That's the theme throughout. Is this theme, and that makes sense if you live in this, pre-modern culture in which a certain kind of authoritarianism was considered to be the natural way of things, and in which people projected earthly monarchy into the heavens. But doesn't make sense at all if you take present day ethical or political theory and try to work out what a ruler of the universe would be like. I'm not even sure like the phrase ruler makes sense if you try to really work out how those ideas would work together. But if you did so, I don't think that you'd end up with this kind of like heavenly monarchy.
Right. Well, let's go on to the last topic now, which is the...
Hold on. Let me just say one more thing about this.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex. Absolutely. Yeah.
The right... There's another aspect to this which is really ridiculous. I mean, is Craig saying, well, you know, if they just run away, they wouldn't have been killed. So it's like, that's not so bad, right? They didn't have to be killed. It's kind of their fault for not running away. If only they'd run away, the honourable Israeli soldiers wouldn't have had to, like, destroy them all down to the last thing. But... I mean, did God reveal the message to the Canaanites that he, you know, A, was God and that all of their religion was false, and convince them about that, and then tell them, by the way, I've given your land away to these guys who are coming, so you need to disappear? Because like, if he didn't do that, how are they supposed to know that they have to leave? I mean, are they supposed to take the Israelis' words for it? Like the oncoming army tells them, oh, by the way, God is on our side and you need to leave. That's what every invading army throughout the whole of history has said. Does Craig think that like it's their fault for not just leaving, you know? And I think it just feels like wrong not to say that there's some relevance to contemporary Middle Eastern politics that's going on. Right now, there is an Israeli army forcing people who used to live on that bit of land out and telling them to leave. And if you don't leave, we're going to destroy that bit of land, right? Like, I'm not making a direct comparison. I don't think they're doing that because of this story here or anything, really. I mean, I don't think just as likely it could have been the British doing the same sort of thing to whatever, some other nation. I'm not saying there's anything about the Israelis, right? Don't get me wrong. I'm not making a point about, you know, the Jews or anything like that, of course. But what I'm saying is that, like, there's something so horribly distasteful about, like, the way that Craig is sanctioning this type of action, coming up with, like, rationalizations for it, rather than just accepting the obvious, barefaced, appalling nature of that type of action. And that those those political messages still being beamed around the world today to justify stuff like that, like right now. And it just happens by pure coincidence that it's like in the same part of the world right now that that's happening. And it's just as appalling now as it was then. And maybe it's even worse now because there's like way more people that are involved. I don't know. But anyway, it just feels wrong not to point that out, that like there's a massive contemporary relevance to the type of thing that Craig's saying. He's talking about it in a dry theological setting, but you can tune in and watch people making those same sorts of arguments in political settings today about real people actually dying right now and justifying it. If only they'd left and they wouldn't have been destroyed by the bombs that we rained down on their houses or whatever. Like, you know, it's, and I guess, I mean, whilst I'm thinking it through, it's one of the things about it is it assumes from the start that the person, the people who are the victims of the violence, don't have any justification, any rights. They don't belong to that place. I mean, no one really belongs to anywhere, it seems to me. But like, no one can just tell you, like, we own this now, get out, kind of thing. That's fundamentally like not cool, like, you know. And just like the backdrop of Craig's thought here was that not only is it fine and that God said that they don't belong there anymore, so they don't, but also they should have accepted that. Like, epistemically, they had no possibility of coming to that conclusion, right? So it's completely beyond any of them to rationally come to it. If any of them did and think, oh, these guys must have God behind them, I should leave, that would have been irrational. They would have been irrational for thinking that. So Craig's complaining that they're not like a stopped clock accidentally showing the right time, coming to some absurd conclusion that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's their fault if they don't do that, and that somehow justifies it. I mean, the more I think about it, the crazier it is. It's just absurd. Anyway, rant.
So I
go on, Dan. One last thing, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah. Well, I wrote down a note before we discussed, and I think it's related to this point. So I think it's worth like mentioning, because otherwise, I think some viewers will accuse us of like strawman and Craig. So in the video with Alex O'Connor, Craig presents his argument in terms of two propositions. First being that God is all just and all loving.
Oh, Dad, let me interrupt you, because that's going to be in the next clip.
That moral obligations arise as a result of imperatives issued by the paradigm of goodness himself, who is God. Now, presumably, God doesn't issue commands to himself as to what he should do. And therefore, on this theory, God has no moral obligations to fulfill. And therefore, as you rightly said, it's impossible that God could do something wrong, because right and wrong are defined by divine commands, and God doesn't issue commands to himself to obey. So what constraint is there then on the moral commands of God? Well, it will be his own perfectly good nature, his own just and loving nature, that will determine whether or not a command is available to him. Now, what this means is that there are lots of actions then that God can perform that would be prohibited morally to us. For example, you wouldn't have the moral right to kill me. But if God wants to strike me dead right now, that's his prerogative. God takes and gives life as he wills. So if God wills to end the life of the Canaanite children prematurely, that's his prerogative. First would be that God is all just and all loving. And the second in this case would be that God has issued a command to Israel to drive out the Canaanites on pain of death from the land. And so my argument is that those two propositions are completely consistent with each other, because God wrongs no one in issuing such a command. And if he wrongs no one, then there is no moral constraint on his issuing such a command.
Dan, tell us what you were going to say, because you were going to pick up on that theme. So go ahead.
Right. So he presents us with two propositions. First is that God is all just and all loving. Second is that God issues a command to drive out the Canaanites and pain of death from the land. Now, Craig wants to say that these two propositions are logically consistent with one another, because God wrongs no one in issuing such a command. And if God wrongs no one, then there are no moral constraints on God issuing such a command. Well, to start with, I don't understand why Craig is addressing the logical consistency between these two propositions. The discussion between Craig and Alex O'Connor dates back to some blog posts that Craig wrote and to a response that Dawkins wrote for The Guardian. And neither of those blog posts does Craig phrase his argument in terms of defending the logical consistency of these two propositions. Moreover, Dawkins doesn't argue that the two propositions are contradictory. At one point in the second of the two blog posts, Craig does say that since, in his view, naturalists cannot maintain objective moral values or duties, the problem must only be about the internal consistency of Christian theology, that this depends upon at least two claims that many philosophers would themselves controvert, namely, that objective morality must depend upon God, and that no one other than a moral objectivist can legitimately deliver moral admonishments. And so Craig is clearly begging the question.
Just to explain to the viewers that the Guardian article, I believe that what you're talking about was when he said, I refuse to debate William Lane Craig because he is a defender of genocide. That's what we were talking about here, right?
Right. Yes, yeah. That's correct. Yeah. The Guardian article is where Dawkins says that he won't be debating Craig. And I don't know, at least the way that Dawkins describes Craig's behavior in the article makes Craig almost sound like he had been stalking Dawkins. I don't know if any of that's true, but that's the way that Dawkins presents it. If it is true, then I think there's like further reasons that Dawkins has not to debate it. But I can certainly understand just on a purely ethical level, like why someone would find this abominable. And it has nothing to do with the supposed contradiction between these two propositions. Like the charitable way to read the situation, if you are going to make reference to these two propositions, is that there's tension between the two propositions. That in other words, the conjunction of the two propositions is implausible, and deeply implausible given moral intuitions that most of us take to be more obvious to us than we do the truth of these particular theological claims. And in fact, you know, probably many theologians, like Randall Rouser, for instance, find the moral intuitions they have more plausible than the literal truth of the Canaanite or Amalekite genocides.
I don't know if I could phrase it off the top of my head as a contradiction, so to make it seem like a logical problem necessarily, but like, it does seem to be a bit weird. Like, let's just grant for the sake of argument that God isn't under any obligations, kind of a loophole in the contract that just means that he doesn't actually command himself to do anything, so therefore blah blah blah. But Craig does still think that he's constrained, as you said there, by his own perfectly good nature. And I do wonder, how is it that we're able to reconcile being perfect? What does perfectly good mean? What's the content of that? If it allows you to just issue orders to kill, you know, loads of people. I mean, is this why, does he then need to say, well, they deserved it, and that's why it's compatible with his perfect goodness, right? Does he need it to be absolutely every single 100% of them were morally bankrupt and therefore deserve to die?
Well,
right?
That can't be the right answer, because moral desert has to do with obligation, right? Like the, if God doesn't have an obligation here, and God doesn't, and so because God doesn't have any obligations to either fulfill or to violate, God can't therefore wrong anyone. It can't be the case that like God does something to someone that they didn't deserve, because that phrasing it that way would say that like God has some moral obligation that God violated. But I think there's something very close by. So suppose that you said to a Christian, well, how do we know that God didn't just inspire a holy book that's filled from cover to cover with lies? Like, how do we know that like the Bible isn't just chock full of lies, even though it was inspired by God? And presumably what they would say is that, well, God is perfectly good. And in virtue of being perfectly good, God wouldn't lie to us, right? And if that's the case, then even though God doesn't have any moral obligations, so God wouldn't be violating a moral obligation by lying to us, nonetheless, it's the case that God would be contravening God's own nature by lying to us. Likewise, I think it's plausible that God would be, I think all of us have the intuition that God would be contravening God's own nature were God to order the mass slaughter of a people group. And not just a people group, but like, you know, all of the infants in that group and all of the non-human animals in that region.
And presumably unborn babies as well in the wombs of women who got killed.
That's right.
Basically abortion, right?
Yeah.
But somehow that's not okay in contemporary America,
so,
but it's okay.
As far as I can, as far as I can tell, there's a fork here that we can present to Craig. Like, either it's the case that God has, there's just like no constraints on what God does. There's just no reason why God wouldn't like hand us a holy book that's just chock full of lies. Or it's the case that there are constraints, maybe not constraints in virtue of moral obligations, maybe constraints in virtue of God's nature as a perfectly good being. But what, you know, if God has the kind of constraints on God's behavior that God wouldn't provide us a holy book chock full of lies, then equally, the same kind of constraints should make it the case that God wouldn't order people to commit the mass slaughter of a people group and all of the non-human animals among them.
I mean, I've always wondered, we could imagine that there is a perfectly just and loving God, but that it's not the character described in the Bible. If we want to know, well, is the character described in the Bible the one that we think is the perfectly just and loving God? Don't we look at the text and see what he does? I mean, what else can we do? I mean, of course, we have the Gnostics. The Gnostics believed that the Old Testament God was evil and that Jesus was a different God, right? That's a perfectly consistent position. So I don't think you can just dodge the horrific things that we find in the Old Testament by saying, well, God is perfectly good. This must be perfectly good. That doesn't seem to follow to me.
That's right. That's right. I think so. Now, a Christian might say the following. They might say to us, "Well, God understands morality at a level that we don't have comprehension of it. God understands things in general that we don't have a comprehension of, and so presumably there's going to be things that, just as it would have been counterintuitive to many people living, say, 2,000 years ago, that slavery is wrong. God has always known that slavery is wrong, and so there's going to be things that, like today, we would take to be counterintuitive, but God knows why that they are the morally right things to do. However, when we evaluate a putative theological claim, while we ought to make room for the possibility that God behave in ways that we find surprising, given the way that God's moral knowledge surpasses ours, we have to also consult our moral intuitions. I mean, this is exactly what Craig would do were he to evaluate the claims made by some other religion, right? When it comes to evaluating Islam, or, I mean, as we discussed earlier in this conversation, when it comes to evaluating ancient Canaanite religion, apparently what Craig would say is that those other religions do not represent genuine revelations from God because they violate moral intuitions that we know in a very deep-seated way. Well, apply the same principle here, and you get that we shouldn't accept the truth of these theological claims. And so, as Dawkins points out, there are theologians who think that these kinds of stories about the Canaanites and the Amalekites shouldn't be taken literally, and that those are the more plausible theological positions to take up.
Right. So I'm going to, Alex, closing thoughts, because we're running over time a bit. So anything last you want to say before we close things out?
Yeah, I guess one thing I just wanted to briefly touch on was the idea that in the video, Alex brought up the idea that, like, well, couldn't somebody just, you know, ape these justifications that you're talking about now and use them to kill any old person, right? You know, I think you brought up the case of like a mother who'd killed their kids and thought that God was telling them to do that or whatever. And Craig's reply to that was, it just struck me so flimsy and ridiculous. It was about, like, well, you know, that you might think that you've got justification from God from that happening because you could be hallucinating that the booming voice tells you to do it or whatever. Or you might hallucinate that you've found a passage in the Bible where it tells you to do it or something. But you wouldn't actually have justification for that. You just think that you would, which is a bizarre notion anyway. But it just struck me that, like, isn't that taking for granted that all of that same kind of epistemic ambiguity just wasn't present at the time from the Israelites? I mean, isn't that a live possibility that just like that woman who killed their kids, but it wasn't actually God who was telling her to do it, that is just what happened in the whole history of Christianity. It's just people thinking that God was telling them to do stuff and actually it wasn't. You know, that just, how do you know that? And he just sort of hand-waved this idea of, like, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something about how they definitely had authentic revelation.
And I think he said it was self-authenticating, if I remember right.
God, did he actually say self-authenticating?
I might be misremembering that. I'm not sure, but I think that's what he said.
Yeah, I thought he said that, but then I thought that was a kind of presupposition. It's nonsense that he wouldn't have said, but I mean, maybe he is reaching for that at this point as well. But yeah, it just seemed to me that that was another one of these, like, chasms, a sort of unbridgeable chasm of... his argument that he just seemed to hop over as if it was nothing. So yeah, I just sort of flagged that one as well.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we've gone over time a little bit, and well, we'll end the show there. So thank you, Alex. Thanks, Dan. For anyone in the audience, if you like this, please hit like and subscribe. If you want to see another one of these, put in the comments maybe a topic you'd like us to discuss. We have here, I think, like two of the best atheists that are out there in philosophy. So please, please, give us your suggestions, and hopefully we can do this again.